Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's the biggie, the A-list economic indicator, gross domestic product. The value of every car, consulting contract, and cup of coffee this economy turned out last quarter. And as you might have guessed, there were a whole lot less of them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 30th of January. Good to have you here. I just wish there was a way to start without telling you this. The gross domestic product last quarter withered like we haven't seen since 1982. The economy produced 3.8% less stuff October through New Year's than it did at the end of the summer. Believe it or not, that was better than anybody thought it was going to be. But this is one of those stories where there are numbers hiding behind the headline data that tell us there's even worse news to come, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Here's the deal. Gross domestic product counts everything made in the economy, including stuff that's made and then sits around on a shelf somewhere, in a factory, a warehouse, or a local store, not getting sold. These inventories have been building up fast. Sales, meanwhile, have been falling hard. That means the whole supply chain is backing up, according to economist Nigel Gault of IHS Global Insight.
And that says that as we go into the first quarter, there are going to have to be some sharp production cutbacks in order to work off those excess inventories.
The production backup starts at the other end of the supply chain, with customers who aren't buying, meaning retailers aren't ordering from wholesalers. To see this process in action, I headed to a commercial strip here in Portland, Oregon. Langlitz Leathers has been making jackets, saddlebags, and the like for the biker crowd for more than 60 years. Manager Dave Hansen says sales have slowed a bit in the past 6 months, though not disastrously. He's managing that by running lean.
We are trying to keep our inventory from getting out of hand. We don't want to expand our inventory, so there's no point in stocking all the odd sizes in a tight economy.
Just up the road is Portico Furniture. Its counters are chock full of vases, picture frames, the odd throw rug. Johann Mayer is the owner.
It's more like the lamps, the accessories that I'm ordering way less of.
Mayer says he hasn't seen a sales slump this bad in the 7 years he's been in business.
Overall, the sales are quite a bit down, and what I'm doing is trying to refocus my business and trying to do more custom furniture, more local furniture.
That way, Mayer says, he won't have to order as many sofas and coffee tables from suppliers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
When Congress votes on a package worth $800 billion, people pay attention. And that has made the vote in the House earlier this week, the one in which not a single Republican voted in favor of the stimulus bill, the first political football of the Obama administration. Groups affiliated with the Democrats are airing ads in states that have Republican senators, trying to put pressure on them to back the stimulus when the Senate votes next week. Republicans in the House, on the other hand, are mounting a campaign to defend their unanimous vote against it, and they are targeting cities and states that are set to get billions from Washington if the bill does pass. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Republican Mick Cornett is the mayor of Oklahoma City. Now, not a single one of Oklahoma's 77 counties voted for President Obama in November. Still, this is Mayor Cornett's reaction to the House vote on the stimulus, which his representative voted against.
Well, I suppose it's disappointing to see a partisan vote on something that I think will help a lot of people, but I think there are oversight issues, and Republicans are rightfully concerned about too much pork.
Republican Mayor Leonard Urban of Connersville, Indiana, is fine with the no vote from his representative, Mike Pence. Urban says Connersville probably won't get much money anyway, since projects have to be shovel-ready.
Well, how many of us small towns like us can have a planning stage on $1 million or $500,000 project when we had no money to begin with?
Colorado Springs Mayor Lionel Rivera, also a Republican, does have projects ready to go. But in his extremely red part of the country, he's cool with the no vote from Congressman Doug Lamborn.
I hope a stimulus plan is passed that is dramatically revised, that puts more money into infrastructure projects that will actually build highways and help spur job creation and commerce. Our list of highway projects, we think will do that.
And in Glen Cove, New York, on Long Island, Democratic Mayor Ralph Suozzi hardly has time to think about the stimulus package. But he says he doesn't begrudge his rep, Republican Peter King, for voting against it.
The final package still has to be resolved, and I think overall, I think he'll support any final package that comes out because it'll be good for the region.
Good for the region, that is, as long as the congressman brings something home. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Oil closed today just shy of $42 a barrel. Seeing as how there are 42 gallons to each one of those barrels of crude, that means oil's at just under a dollar a gallon right now. At the pump, meanwhile, we are paying a national average of $1.89 a gallon to fill up our gas tanks, which kind of gets us into this next story. At a time when most corporate profits are falling off a cliff, ExxonMobil is sitting pretty. The world's largest publicly traded oil company announced today that it raked in a record $45 billion in profit last year, breaking its own record, by the by. And even the stunning drop in oil prices over the past 6 months hasn't hit Exxon as hard as it has hit the company's rivals. And it makes you wonder what Exxon's doing that the rest of corporate America isn't. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Go through the list of financial strategies that helped bring today's economy to its knees, and you'd be hard-pressed to find any that fit Exxon's corporate culture.
Exxon is the antithesis of a 21st century corporation.
Philip Verleger is an oil economist. He says while much of corporate America was swept up in the frenzy of short-term, high-risk bets, Exxon plodded along as it always has.
They have operated and managed in a way that looks at the long-term survival of the corporation, the long-term growth of the corporation, and really paid very little attention to short-term results.
For example, when oil prices were high, Exxon resisted the urge to overspend on new, harder-to-reach sources of oil. Instead, Exxon amassed a cash reserve of nearly $40 billion. Verleger says if more companies had acted like Exxon, the economy might be in less of a pickle today. But University of Delaware business professor Charles Elson says Exxon's strategy is far from foolproof.
It gives you the luxury to play something out through various economic cycles. On the other hand, it's got the negative that because it's so long-term that you may never be held accountable for the failure that it engenders in the long term.
The auto industry's bet on trucks and SUVs being the prime example. Elson says even Exxon isn't immune. With a new global climate deal in the works and the U.S. now serious about regulating emissions, tomorrow's windfall oil profits may be a lot harder to come by. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
I wanted to update our final note from yesterday's broadcast. We played tape of the president blasting Wall Street bonuses as shameful. Today, one of Mr. Obama's supporters in the Senate announced a plan to do something about that. Missouri's Claire McCaskill said she's going to introduce a bill limiting pay for executives of companies that take bailout money to what the chief executive makes, a presidential and still respectable $400,000 a year. No dollar signs on Wall Street today. Not too many, anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Freddie Mac made some real estate news today. The mortgage giant said it's going to start letting some homeowners and tenants stay in houses that have been foreclosed on. It's not going to be free. There will be rent to pay. And it's not entirely altruistic either. Houses that are lived in stay in better shape than empty ones do. So you could say that Freddie's protecting its investments. And you could ask whether private lenders are going to follow Freddie's lead. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Here's how it works. If Freddie Mac owns the mortgage on your house and it's foreclosed upon, you get to stay on, paying rent to Uncle Freddie. The new policy applies to mortgage holders and to people renting houses in foreclosure. Fannie Mae offers a similar deal, but only to renters. Affordable housing advocates are calling on private lenders to join in. David Barenbaum is executive vice president of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
We heard from some lenders that they are beginning to initiate rental plans modeled on what Fannie and Freddie have done, while others are still examining it.
3 months ago, they probably would have said, forget it.
That's Guy Sakala, publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. He says at this point, private lenders are just trying to stem their losses, and renters can help protect their property just by taking a hot shower.
You need somebody to run the utility, the heat, otherwise you have frozen pipes, you have basically environmental damage.
Sakala thinks the Obama administration should use Freddie's program as a template for helping homeowners facing foreclosure. He says there's no broad solution, and this could be one of many smaller proposals. But Mark Zandi disagrees. Zandi is chief economist for Moody'sEconomy.com. He says the Obama administration must think beyond Freddie's little plan.
What the administration has to do is get to the heart of the problem. If someone gets into foreclosure and they have lost the home, then the administration hasn't done enough because we're trying to forestall that.
Zandi says one way to do that is for lenders to reduce the size of mortgages for homeowners in trouble. He says existing solutions like lowering interest rates and stretching out loans aren't working. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
As Mitchell Hartman explained to get us going today, as bad as the GDP number was, it could get worse as the economy unloads all that built-up inventory. To help digest that fact and to wrap up the happenings this week from Wall Street and beyond, we've got Felix Salmon from Portfolio.com with us once again. Also, Megan McArdle from The Atlantic. Good to have you both here.
Good to talk to you, Kay.
Thanks for having me.
Megan, I'm going to start with you, and obviously we have to go straight to the GDP numbers today because that's the headline story. I'm wondering if you think that now finally everybody's going to get it, that this is bad and getting worse.
There's this really interesting question about this is, I think what we're looking for, right, is for the market to capitulate, to admit that everything's bad and then start growing again. But this sort of paradox of capitulation is, as long as people think that it's capitulated, you haven't capitulated yet. As long as you think that it's going to go up sometime in the near future, you actually haven't emotionally taken it all in.
All right, wait a second. You mean after last fall and the ride that we've had, the market hasn't capitulated yet, Felix?
I think she's right, actually. I think the market has been sort of moving sideways for the past couple of months, and it's been going up and down randomly. But I haven't seen this kind of, oh, wow, things are actually genuinely worse than we thought they would be in November, when in fact they are genuinely worse.
Yeah, I want to go back to something you said, actually, when we had John maybe 6 weeks or 2 months ago. You said it's going to get worse before it gets worse. Is that what we're seeing now?
Yeah, this is the first getting worse. And the next getting worse is going to come along in a couple more months.
Megan, what do you say? Another couple of months until it gets worse yet again?
There's a history with these financial crises of, there's a lull. It's like you go through the eye of the hurricane and everyone starts to think, okay, maybe that was it. And then something hits again. In the Great Depression, you had the first banking panic in 1930 and the second in 1932. The fact is that people sort of step back. They think maybe they've seen the worst. And then they start to really getting down to fairly valuing the assets that have gone bad, whether we nationalize or buy the assets or whatever we end up doing, we are going to push to value this stuff fairly and not let banks throw good money after bad or let it drag down their balance sheets for 10 years.
Felix, let me pick up on that. You've been writing a lot about the nationalization of banks. What's your sense of where it stands in terms of the politics of this whole thing?
It's a very good question. At the moment, the politics is nowhere near nationalization. They are quite keen to do anything but nationalization, which I think is a little bit short-sighted, and nationalization makes a lot of sense in this situation. What's quite clear is that right now they only have $350 billion to play with, the second tranche of the TARP money. And they haven't decided what they want to do with that until they've really come up with a big strategic solution for the entire banking sector in the United States. And I have a feeling that when that bill comes out, then I think you might start beginning to see the second wave of capitulation, as it were, when people really starts to sink in that there's $3 or 4 trillion worth of losses just sitting in the financial sector, which someone is going to have to take.
That's a big number, Megan. $3 to $4 trillion, you think that's it?
We're in this debate over, do we nationalize? Do we buy the assets? We don't even know how big the problem is. What about not having that debate yet and instead send, take all of these laid off bankers, build some crack teams of auditors and send them out to figure out what's on the books?
All right, so Felix, what do you think we ought to do next? If Megan wants to figure out what the problem is, what about you?
Well, Megan seems to believe that it's possible to look at a bank's loan book and put a value on it and be able to just quantify these things. And I don't believe it's possible to quantify these things.
No, I mean, I think that Felix does raise a really good point, which is that we're not going to be able to go in. You know, banking in the 1930s was relatively simple. We're not going to be able to go in and say, you know, definitively exactly what's worth what. But, you know, these sort of more exotic risks with mortgage-backed securities and mortgages and, you know, how far underwater are those houses, there are certainly things where you can at least identify the extent of the exposure. You don't necessarily know which loans are going to pay off or not, but you can identify, you know, sort of how deep are these banks in to the kinds of securities that are really toxic rather than just sort of ordinary loans that carry ordinary credit risk.
It's reassuring that we may possibly never know.
We have nothing to fear but fear itself.
That's right. Megan McArdle edits the Business Channel for The Atlantic. Felix Salmon blogs at Portfolio.com. Thanks, guys.
Cheers, Guy.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Brits consider the future of their economy.
In terms of what the Treasury has, is there's only limited funds as far as I can see. And what happens when the pot is empty?
But first, let's do the numbers. Those disastrous GDP numbers and more lousy profit news torpedoed the Dow today. It sank 148 points, more than 1.75%, to cap the week barely clinging to the 8,000 level. The Nasdaq lost 31 points, just over 2%, finished at 1476. The S&P 500 dropped 19 points, more than 2.25%, wrapped up trading at 825. Here you go. Here's a tally for the opening month of 2009. The Dow has fallen 8.8% since the start of the year. The Nasdaq shed 6.4%. The S&P 500, you ask? Turned in its worst January ever, skidding 8.6%. Procter & Gamble makes the necessities, but it's warning that we're not buying as many of them lately. Don't know what that means. P&G stock slid more than 6% today, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up February 2nd. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending and construction spending. Both releases look at December. The Institute for Supply Management releases its manufacturing index for the month of January. And make Monday a good day, in case you have to repeat it over and over and over, like the movie Groundhog Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown made something of a gaffe at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland today. And let this be a lesson to you, you know, if you're ever giving a press conference at a major global media event.
But our third priority, and this is essential for the maintenance of jobs and for the recovery of businesses, is yet to be put in place in all countries. And this is the resumption of lending to the real... I'm afraid that's my phone.
So we have reached Bloomberg's Tom Keane in Davos to talk about what's been going on at the forum this week. Tom, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Kai.
You've been in Davos, what, 3-4 days now?
Oh, 3 or 4 days. I've been here a number of years. But you come up the valley from Zurich. You take the long, hour train ride or so, and you come into a wonderland. This year it's a little bit different, but it's been an interesting 3-4 days.
Well, explore that for a minute. How is it different than last year, say?
I don't want to overplay the gloom. The media headlines are the gloom of Davos and the collapse of the system. There's still an academic and intellectual excitement here, but that fervor of investment banking and of finance is decidedly missing this year.
What does it say, then, that a lot of the people at the center of this crisis, whether it's investment bankers or members of the new administration, Larry Summers and the Secretary of the Treasury, Tim Geithner, what does it say that they're not there to help try to figure this thing out?
Well, I think it's less about Davos and more the challenges that each of these parties has back at home, whether it's in Europe or Asia or in the United States. They could have come here. They would have learned a lot. And again, a number of government officials did come from other nations. It was maybe less about Davos and more really pressing issues for the Obama administration that really forced them to stay in Washington.
Do you think there will be a time when we look back at this year's Davos and say, hey, that's where they figured out the global economy and that's why things turned around?
It's a great question, but no, it's there's this idea that there's a big crystal ball up here. There isn't. I really don't think we're going to say this is a pivot point. In fact, there's a standard joke among those that come here that whatever the theme is for a given year, they always get it wrong. In fact, it could be the polar opposite. You don't come out of Davos with a plan. What you come out of it with is a lot of discussion, including heated political discussion, which has been the theme this year with the speech by Putin, and also the slam down we had with the Prime Minister of Turkey and the President of Israel. That occurred yesterday. That was been the real surprise here. The political debate, Kai, has really been front and center.
Help me out, though, Tom. I thought it was supposed to be a World Economic Forum.
Good point. It's a political economic forum. I've always said that. Yes, it's talk of stimulus. Yes, it's talk about jobs, of course, and the horrendous layoffs we've seen recently. But there's a big part of politics here as well, not only the global agenda, but people with their pet projects, the whims that happen year to year.
What's the takeaway going to be then from Davos 2009?
I think the takeaway this year, without question, is a single word, trust. I saw it on the side of a bus. Richard Edelman, the PR giant, kicked it off with his annual opening breakfast. And if there's one word that's been percolating through the system here, how do elites, and particularly business elites, those beleaguered CEOs, how do they win back the trust of their shareholders and, for that matter, the public at large?
Well, exactly. Make that connection between Davos and what's happening in Middle America right now.
I think there's an important connection. The CEOs get beat up by their shareholders. They get beat up by the media. They're acutely aware that somebody's got to go to the revenue line. Somebody's got to buy the products. That's that middle America you talk about. It's not just one discussion, Kai. It's many, many discussions through these 4 days about how do you earn back the trust and indeed the loyalty of middle America, or for that matter, the middle advanced economies. That's going to be the project forward to next year.
Bloomberg's Tom Keene in Davos. Tom, thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.
Energy workers are on strike across the United Kingdom today. Thousands of them are protesting the use of foreign labor, even as the unemployment rate in Britain is rising. There have been similar demonstrations in half a dozen European countries. Governments are being blamed for not being able to pull their economies out of recession. In the UK, a second multi-billion-dollar bank bailout has definitely not been well received, with some economists adding insult to injury by saying it could turn England into another Iceland. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
The UK Treasury has poured hundreds of billions of pounds into shoring up the banks, but the recession is deepening and usually resilient Londoners are losing hope.
I feel that at the moment we could actually go bust, and I don't think that anybody in charge actually really knows where to go from here. I think they're all guessing.
You really think the whole country could go bust?
I really do think so, yeah.
Can I ask you, do you think Britain is the new Iceland? London is Reykjavik on Thames?
Yes.
So you think it's that bad?
I think so. In terms of what the Treasury has, is there's only limited funds as far as I can see. And what happens when the pot is empty?
19.9. Currency dealers are worried about that too. Last week they drove the pound down to $1.35, a 23-year low against the greenback. Dealers fear the British government is making promises it can't keep. guaranteeing the British banks when the banks' liabilities are four times bigger than the UK's gross domestic product. Economist Will Hutton.
The amount of red ink, if you put the UK budget deficit next year together with the amount of new liabilities that the taxpayer is having to underwrite, we look like Iceland on Thames.
When Iceland's banks went bust, their liabilities were almost 10 times the size of the country's economy. Iceland had to beg the International Monetary Fund to bail it out. Hutton says Britain may have to do the same. Being lumped in with Iceland was bad enough, but then American investment guru Jim Rogers urged everyone to dump the pound. He told British TV viewers, "Your currency is a busted flush."
North Sea oil is drying up, and the financial system, which has also been a huge contributor to the UK's balance of trade, is also now finished. So the major sources of income for the UK are now disappearing, and that's going to lead to serious problems with your currency. It always has.
Many analysts dismissed Rogers' remarks as ridiculous. And they said it was absurd to compare Iceland with the world's sixth largest economy. But this week, a ship sailed through the winter fog into the English port of Grimsby on a mercy mission with a cargo of aid for beleaguered and shivering Brits.
Woolly jumpers, socks and caps and mittens and scarves and blankets.
Heimir Karlsson is a radio host in Iceland. His listeners were so touched by the plight of poor British pensioners, they sent the UK a container full of warm winter clothing. Iceland may have been battered by the economic crisis, but Heimir reckons it's better equipped than Britain to weather the storm.
We are in many ways self-sufficient. We have the geothermal energy to warm our houses, so no one needs to be cold. And we can be self-sufficient when it comes to food.
Comparisons with Iceland are acutely uncomfortable for the British government. For more reasons than one, this week Iceland's ruling coalition collapsed, the first government casualty of the financial crisis. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, a cautionary tale for those of you who share passwords and logins for subscription-only sites. Financial Times has had about enough of that. The paper sued billionaire Steve Schwarzman this week. He runs the private equity firm Blackstone. The Financial Times says Blackstone has been sharing a single user ID among thousands of employees. No word on how much the paper is looking for in damages, but you do have to wonder why the FT doesn't do what the Wall Street Journal does, only let one computer be logged in with the same username at one time. I'm just saying, from, you know, personal experience around here. Here is Marketplace from American Public Media. That's it for us. Today, the Dow dropped 148 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ fell 31 points, 2%. The S&P 500 shook off 19 points, 2.25%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, what exactly is a green-collar job?
A green-collar job, in our definition, is one that pays family-supporting wages, that produces products for Americans, and improves the environment.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.